Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. This is the session on the Commonwealth's Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme White Paper, and this is the last call, so if you're on the wrong aircraft, now's the time to leave. I'm your chairman for this session, Trevor Thompson, and I'm now going to be introducing Peter Eben, who is kindly running this session. Peter may or may not be known to many of you, but I have an extensive CV in front of me, but I guess the bottom line of it, in the interest of time, is that Peter's a professional that's been working in this field, both in terms of senior management positions and as a consultant over the last 15 years or so, and has a very extensive background in advising a very wide range of clients, from government departments through to government on policy, and worked with a whole range of energy companies. So he's very well qualified, and as I say, he's been intimately involved in all this. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce Peter to take us through this topic.
Thanks.
Can everyone hear me? Yep. Thanks, Trevor. Appreciate that. I guess I want to make this as interactive as possible, and I'm not here to sort of lecture people on, you know, what the business implications and opportunities are. I think it's really the latter half. It's the opportunities. I think that there is a great wealth of knowledge within the actuarial profession that really, if it's harnessed and applied appropriately, can really add a lot of value to address some of the problems that are out there right now that not only the Australian government is facing, but also internationally people are facing. And I guess that's what I want to try and do here, is really more so stimulate discussion and thought as opposed to lecturing you about, you know, this is the design of the CPRS, because, you know, people, if they want to, they can read up on the design of the CPRS anyway. So I'll cover four areas, a quick introduction, then I will very briefly give you an overview of it just to sort of, you know, sort of whet the appetite a little bit, but then focus on sectoral and business level impacts, and then more importantly, opportunities for the profession. So if we start with this one here, I'll just wait for the other guys to come in. If we start at the big picture level, what this is trying to show is that this is a global problem. What you've got here in the chart is basically where emissions are at the moment. So this is the emissions currently sort of 1990 level. These are the projected emissions up to 2050. If the developed world basically becomes carbon neutral, which means Australia, Europe, UK, America, things like that, you get here. However, the science tells us that we have to get down to there. This is therefore a global problem. To put it in magnitude, you're talking about 5,000 coal-fired power stations, 1,000 times Australia's renewable energy target, or 110 times California's emissions have to be avoided between now and 2050. It is a global problem. It's not just an Australian problem. It's not just a developed world problem. It is a global problem. Just very quickly, Australia's emissions, no surprises there, 50% of Australia's emissions are from stationary energy. Huge coal dependency. The next biggest is agriculture, which is our large farming sector, and the third biggest is transport. That's just to put it in perspective of where we get our emissions from, and you'll see the trend going up for stationary energy on the right. That's our emissions from 1990 through to 2006. It did take a dip. The driver of that dip was the land use and land use change, so the avoided deforestation. That's what caused that dip coming through. The carbon market, how has that gone between 2006 and 2007? These are the most recent stats from the World Bank. Probably around about May this year they'll be doing the next report, which will look at 2007 versus 2008. But what you can see is from a volume perspective, the European market still dominates because there is no American market, there is no big Australian market yet. That's roughly doubled in size. The one that's more interesting is this CDM, which stands for Clean Development Mechanism. The physical market, which is this CDM 551, that basically stayed the same size, times 1.0. But the secondary one, which is where the financial instruments come in and the secondary trading of it, that grew 10 times between 2006 and 2007 in terms of volume. If you look at this one here, which is value, very similar statistics. Very similar statistics. The standout growth was the secondary CDM market. So, which, you know, is showing that there's great opportunities in terms of secondary markets rather than just primary markets. what's the broad policy objectives? Why are we doing it here? Obviously, the first one is to achieve the emissions reduction targets. I mean, that's the key reason for why we're doing it. The second one is to price the carbon externality. Now, you get into the debate there about should it be a tax or should it be a trading scheme. I'm not going to get into that debate today. I mean, that is still going around everywhere, and, you know, we could spend probably half a day just debating that one alone. But, you know, clearly you have to price it. It's there really sending the signals to shift value within the economy, to move it from low, basically high polluting areas to low polluting areas. And most importantly, they want to manage that transition. They don't want to have a cliff edge. They don't want to turn around and say, well, okay, yesterday, you know, these sort of things were fine. Tomorrow, they're all not fine, and just shut these smelters and shut all of these sort of things. That has to be transitioned across so that the economy can manage itself. Especially in current economic times, people appreciate the need for a transition. That's just sort of to give the bigger picture, to sort of set the scene. If we get into a little bit about the CPRS, what is it all about? Key policy milestones, very consistent with what you probably would have seen this morning that Martin from Baker and McKenzie had said, but 2007, Kyoto was ratified. So that was basically the first thing that the new government at the time came in and did. 2008, quite a busy year. You had the Garneau Review, you had the National Greenhouse and Energy Reporting System, the Green Paper and the White Paper. This year, you've already started with the draft bills. So come March this year, basically the government released probably, you know, 1,000-odd pages of draft legislation and commentary. Final bills are expecting to be passed sometime June through to December, but who knows with what's happening with the Senate environment at the moment. But, you know, that's the anticipation of the government. Still at this stage, 2010 to start. July 1 at this stage is the date. 20% target for renewable energy by 2020 and 60% target by 2050. Just sort of very quick milestones. Legislative overview, I won't even go into this because Martin spoke about this, but there are a whole raft of bills and various regulations that are coming in. And again, I won't go into any detail on that. More importantly, I guess, for you guys, what are some of the compliance obligations? So just thinking about it from a business perspective, what are some of the things that businesses will have to do under this one? The very first thing they'll need to do is register. So clearly you have to determine, do you need to register, hence the mandatory, or do you want to register from a voluntary perspective? So that's the first compliance obligation, is actual registration. Then you have to calculate your annual emissions number. So they've now called it an emissions number. That's the government's language for working out your emissions on an annual basis. You have to submit your reports. At the end of the year, you have to surrender your units. So you'll say, okay, I've emitted 1,000 tonnes, whatever it is. You have to then surrender the equivalent of your emissions. If you don't, there are penalties. Relinquishing units basically are for those people that got them for free. You probably are aware that certain industries may get assistance from the government, be it, you know, the coal-fired power stations, be it large sort of, you know, manufacturing businesses. Anyone who gets free units, there are certain measures that will have to happen, and if those measures are breached, then they may have to relinquish those units. An example is if they close a certain part of their production, the government is going to say, well, you have to hand those units back rather than just selling them and cashing in the money. So there's the relinquishment. You have to notify significant holdings, much like significant holdings in shares. The government is interested from a sort of hoarding perspective to make sure that people don't hoard these permits. So you'll have to notify significant holdings. Keeping records is pretty obvious, and audit. So they're the compliance type things that businesses will have to do on an annual basis. From a transactional perspective, so this is now looking at it from a commercial perspective, what are the things that they're going to do instead? They're going to participate in the auction. So there's going to be a periodic auction where the government will sell these permits. So they'll participate in the auction and the settlement of it. There's this concept known as an obligation transfer number. Very confusing and very intricate piece of the legislation, but really critical when it comes to making sure that the right part of the value chain wears the liability for these emissions. And where an obligation transfer number works primarily is in the fuel sector. So if you are imagining that you are a Caltex or one of these large fuel providers, and you are a large fuel user, let's just say a Linfox. So imagine Caltex and Linfox. Linfox may choose to take that liability on themselves, so they may choose and say, look, we're better off managing this ourselves rather than having Caltex or Shell or Mobil manage it on our behalf. What will happen is, much like the way when you prepare a tax invoice and you have to put an ABN, you will, when you buy your fuel, for example, have to quote an OTN, so an obligation transfer number, that basically will say, okay, I'm Linfox, when I buy my fuel off Shell or whoever I'm going to buy it off, I will quote this OTN, and that will make sure that I then wear the liability for any carbon as opposed to Shell. or Caltex or whoever it is. And so there's these massive requirements in there, and it's very complex, but it has a very logical reason, because what they're trying to do is make sure that the most efficient part of the value chain manages this exposure. So that's that whole concept of OTN. Liability transfer certificates basically are within an entity. Some companies, as you could appreciate, have very complex ownership structures, so there are subsidiaries all over the place and various things. Within an entity, you can transfer that liability from one wholly owned subsidiary to another through this concept of liability transfer certificates, much like when you consolidate your, you know, tax records or you consolidate your income statements, the same sort of concept. So that, again, it just makes it efficient so that you don't have, if you're a multi, multi-jurisdictional organisation and things like that, you don't have to worry about reporting separately. You can actually amalgamate it and say, let's do a consolidated view of the world. Clearly, you've got secondary market participation, so that's exactly the same as, you know, secondary markets in any other commodity. You know, you can buy and sell on the futures, or you could buy and sell, you know, over-the-counter type derivatives. And then you've got international market. The government is very keen to open this up internationally in the context of the very first slide. This is a global problem, not just a local problem. So the government is very keen to open it up internationally. So international market participation is clearly another area. So from a transactional perspective, there's those five or so things that businesses will look at doing. I rush through that fairly quickly so that we can get now and spend more time at this section here. So this talks about the sectoral and the business level impacts to organisations of this CPRS. And then, as I said, the last section will be opportunities for actuaries. There are six key drivers that really sum up what is going to cause the impact for a business. And I'll go through them one at a time. The first one is fairly obvious. It's the emissions profile. You know, what you really need to understand is how emissions intensive is your business. I mean, clearly, if you are a coal-fired generator, you are going to be fairly emissions intensive, and so you are going to be fairly exposed. Whereas if you are, I guess, a, you know, widget manufacturer that doesn't use electricity to manufacture the widgets and things like that, you're probably not going to be exposed. So clearly, your carbon intensity is going to be an absolute critical one, and your relative competitiveness, because not all coal-fired power stations are the same. Some coal-fired power stations are more efficient than others. So clearly, the relative competitiveness and your carbon intensity are going to drive your impact at the very highest of levels. The next one down is going to be, what transitional assistance are you going to get from the government? The government is very cognizant of the fact that certain industries need this transitional assistance. As I said, the most obvious ones are the coal-fired generation sector, and that reflects the fact that 50% of our emissions are generated from there. And the second one is what they call the emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries, or EITs, EITEs. Those two sectors of the economy basically will get transitional assistance, and what will determine that is, A, the level, and there's still lots of debates. The government is looking at offering something like $3.9 billion worth of assistance to the coal-fired power stations. There's already heavy debates from the coal-fired sector saying that is nowhere near enough. They're saying you need somewhere between $5 and $10 billion, that with $3.9 billion you will see the closure of some power plants. So the level of assistance is clearly a key factor. The second one is the duration. How many years do they allow this assistance to happen before they turn around and say you're on your own? So that's clearly another one that says how long will this transition allow? And the third one is the eligibility criteria. How do you know if you're in or you're not? And that goes back to the relative competitiveness and things like that. They will set what they call world's best practice benchmark levels. And if you are worse than that, bad luck. If you are at that or better than that, then that's okay, because what they're not trying to promote is inefficiency. The question then comes down to, how do they determine world's best practice? That's going to be a real critical one, because there isn't the data out there to determine what is world's best practice in some of these areas. The third area is how they allocate the caps and the permits. So do they set the target at a 20% reduction? Do they set the target at a 50% reduction? Do they set the target, as some people are saying, at 100% reduction of emissions so that Australia is carbon neutral? So that's where the first one is. Then what do they price the permits at? Do they put a cap on them? And the government has said, OK, in the short term, we will put a cap. They've put in a cap at $40 plus a CPI-type measure. So they've said, OK, for the first few years, we will, you know, restrain this. We will make sure that there's no major price shocks coming through the economy. And then the last one is international linkages. How open and exposed do you want the Australian system to be to what happens internationally? So that's the third area, how they allocate the caps and how they allocate the permits. You've then got the fourth area, which is complementary measures. What tax rebates do they give? what grants, what concessions, you know, renewable energy targets, energy efficiency targets, all these sorts of things that, as I said, complementary type measures that obviously are related to the objective of reducing carbon from the economy. So that's the fourth area of the drivers. The fifth one comes more to then, I guess, a business and a product perspective that says, what's the elasticity in your market? You know, it's all well and good to say, okay, you know, we're going to pass this through, but I guess the first question is, can you pass it through from a contractual perspective? But the second one is probably just as important. Is the market going to let you pass it through? You know, so, and that's going to be really important. You know, what's the pricing and volume impacts on your inputs and outputs? So that's the market elasticity equation. And the last one is the strategy adopted. What are you as an entity going to do strategically from right the way from the very beginning of the value chain, which is adaptation and mitigation, right the way through to potentially trading? And how are you going to beat your competitors at this game? You know, that's really what's going to impact as a business. So they're the six key drivers and, you know, a whole host of factors. And I guess it's important to think about that, you know, a lot of those, I guess there are serious quantitative type problems and long-term problems in here. And that's where I want you guys to start to think that there are actuarial roles that can be had in here. You know, I mean, if you put a similar thing up there that said, what are the business drivers for the insurance sector and things like that, obviously the drivers would be different. But, you know, the concept of long-term, of uncertainty, of risk and things like that are all very similar. You know, there's no reason why we can't apply the same skills that we're doing in the, as I said, the insurance sector, the funds management sector, and think about it just in this context and knowing that sort of language. Because that's all it is. It's learning the new language that's out there, as opposed to learning what you're doing. Just a quick chart here. Hopefully you guys can see it from the back, but I'll explain it very quickly. It's from a company called Reputex, and it's basically they did an analysis of the carbon intensity of the ASX 200. And it's broken into three sectors, into three areas. You've got the orange one, which represents what they call downstream emissions. You've got the light blue ones, which represent what they call direct emissions. And you've got the dark blue, which represent upstream. If you think about that in a value chain perspective and you say, okay, direct emissions are what happens in my part of the value chain. Upstream is what happens before it gets to my part of the value chain, and downstream is what happens after it gets past my part of the value chain. What they've then done is they've ranked basically the ASX 200 sectors in carbon intensity. So what they mean by carbon intensity is it's tons of CO2 per $1 million of revenue. So basically they're standardising it. Rather than looking at it at an absolute level, they're standardising it. No surprises who's sort of one and two, energy and utilities. And for utilities, it's no surprise that it's really the upstream. So if you think about a utility company like an AGL, their large emissions are going to come upstream from the power producers that will have produced the power in the first place, hence why it's upstream. But where it becomes interesting is things like real estate and banks. They're actually up there in the top five. And where they come in is the downstream emissions. If you think about it from a bank's perspective, they have a very large debt portfolio. So they invest, you know, debt-wise into power stations, into all of these other things. Hence, their downstream emissions are quite significant through their debt portfolio. Real estate companies, their downstream emissions come from the people who are actually consuming the electricity, the tenants in their buildings, who consume the electricity that therefore make emissions as a result of that. And on a per $1 million revenue basis, they are actually quite high up there. You know, so it's an important dynamic and it's an interesting dynamic to understand. And that is the whole concept of looking at the whole economic view rather than just where people focus right now, which is the direct view. So people tend to focus on this light blue, and that's all they focus on, whereas what you need to do is broaden your thinking and think about it from the inputs and the outputs, hence that market elasticity concept. If you look at it from a different perspective, obviously in a direct sense, the four sectors that are most impacted are going to be the large direct emitters, energy, utilities, materials and transport. What this is just trying to say is at varying levels of carbon prices, what's the potential EBITDA impact for it? Now, this is not allowing for assistance measures. This is very holistic, high-level type analysis. But it's just trying to say, you know, that, again, for the ASX 200, you've got a fair degree of exposure. Now, it's important to realise that there are no coal-fired power stations in the ASX 200. So if you had coal-fired power stations, they would be probably up at the sort of 70-80% type level. So it's just important to put that in context when you look at these numbers here and the scale here. Probably something a little bit nearer and dearer to your hearts, and I won't go through all of this, but just something that's near and dear to your hearts. How will it impact financial services? Clearly, if you look at financial services, you've got all the different sectors there, retail banking, business banking, institutional funds, GI and life insurance. And again, you know, it's going to impact all of those areas in lots of different ways. I mean, if we take a couple of them, from a general insurance perspective, it's clearly going to impact consumer preferences and cash flows. But more importantly, it's going to impact the physical and the asset exposures, bushfires, floods, things like that. Product design, you know, what are the exclusions? It's going to start to impact it there. So, you know, from a banking perspective, institutional banking, it's going to impact the cash flows of the businesses, the viability of counterparties, their asset exposures. So if you're lending to a power station, you know, what's the likelihood that they're going to be around in 5 years' time? You know, all of those sort of things are going to be really critical. But as I said, I'm not going to go through this in a lot of detail. But, you know, that's just a framework for you guys to at least think about in that context. Probably spend a little bit more time here because this is a little bit nearer and dearer to your hearts in terms of quantifying carbon risk. The usual suspects. Capital expenditure. Where is it going to impact capital expenditure? Clearly, number one is going to be through emissions reductions technology. Are you going to invest in things like energy efficiency, switching your fuel, new investments of technology, things like that? So clearly, carbon will impact the capex of a business. Do you change location? And that could be, do you change countries because you want to avoid a carbon pollution reduction scheme? Or do you change locations because the area that you're in might be prone to bushfires, might be prone to floods, things like that? So that's the next one of CapEx. And then compliance costs. Do you have to invest in new systems, new processes, new reporting regimes? So they're the examples where carbon risk will impact from a capital expenditure perspective. If you look at it on the operating expenditure perspective, it's going to impact you purely, I guess, number one, buying permits. Do you have to buy permits? So that's going to be just a straight cost. Number two, your supply chain. So remember the chart that I said upstream and downstream. More importantly, upstream. Is someone going to pass it through to you? Is your electricity provider going to increase their costs? Is your fuel provider going to increase their costs? If you're a builder, is the cost of concrete and the cost of steel going to go up? So clearly that's going to impact your operating expenditure. Are there going to be any savings that you might get from abatement costs? You know, or what are the costs and, I guess, potentially savings? So if you spend this money up here, so hence if you spend your capital expenditure, are you going to see, hopefully, a saving as a result? Compliance costs. So again, you've got your capital expenditure view of compliance costs, but you've got also your operating expenditure view of compliance costs. That's just staffing costs and things like that. Putting in, as I said earlier on, you saw in the presentation, the sort of compliance things that businesses are going to have to do. Calculate emissions numbers, surrender permits, audit, report, all of these sort of things. They will make their way into compliance costs there. And then foreign exchange, the international linkages. Businesses are going to be buying and selling permits on an international basis. That will bring in foreign exchange risk because a lot of the permits are denominated in either euros or US dollars. Especially in terms of the volume of the market. The Australian market is going to be relatively small in the overall international context. So clearly, as it becomes international, there's going to be foreign exchange risk that's going to make its way through. Balance sheet. You know, how's it going to impact your balance sheet? Clearly, you've got your physical weather exposure. You know, as I said, bushfires, floods, you know, just heat, things like that that will depreciate. Asset depreciation. So clearly, you know, that could be just revaluing your assets. Things like that. There's M&A activity. You know, are you going to be buying and selling or, you know, divesting parts of your business or acquiring up and down the value chain? And then litigation risk clearly is another one that will impact your balance sheet. Market elements is an interesting one. For listed entities, you know, clearly the beta of companies is going to change, you know, because as it shifts value through the economy, certain sectors are going to become more risky than they were previously and other sectors are going to become less risky than they were previously. So clearly that will impact beta, which will go back to a normal traditional sort of actuarial question that will say asset allocation and investment questions clearly will come in. But also reputation and brand. You know, people are going to be interested in knowing what you're doing and how you're doing it. So clearly that's going to be another one there. And then revenue, last but not least. You know, where's the upside in all this? Because most of this, to be honest, is, you know, downside, you know, and cost. But I guess there is also upside. You can either sell excess credits. So if you do something and invest in the right technology, you can potentially sell some excess credits. Consumer preferences might work towards you. If you're at a certain part of the value chain, for example, renewable energy type companies are booming at the moment. So clearly consumer preferences are moving their way to renewable energy. And so that's an example where your revenue can go up. CDM pipeline, that stands for Clean Development Mechanism. They're the projects under the Kyoto Protocol that people can invest in developing nations. So clearly if you're a company that has, you know, assets in some developing countries, there are opportunities for you to invest in these things and grow them and develop a pipeline of Clean Development Mechanism projects that you can then sell Kyoto-based permits off the back of. And then clearly foreign exchange risk will impact your revenue side, just like it will impact your cost side. Any questions on this one before I move on? Nope. Key question, marginal abatement cost curve. I'm sure some of you may have heard of this concept, but if you haven't, it's an absolutely fundamental concept that really is at the heart of this whole trading scheme. And the question is, do you buy permits or do you reduce your emissions? And the way that businesses will determine which one they do is their marginal abatement cost curve. And what this is trying to stylistically show is that for different, I guess, initiatives, call it initiative A, B, C, D, E, and F, what's the, I guess, relative amount of CO2 that's abated, so that's how much CO2 can get avoided, versus what's the cost of abating that marginal unit of CO2 or marginal ton of CO2. So Project A, what this is saying is that the business will actually save money, it will actually cost them less and they'll actually make money out of abating that ton of CO2. An example of one of those might be retrofitting light globes and things like that. Sometimes the cost of installing some of these energy efficient light globes actually has a payback period and a payback that outweighs the costs. Hence that might be a negative cost. You know, other projects might have a positive cost. What this says is you stack them up from end to end and you basically determine at what point in there does that equal what you think the market price of permits will be. And you obviously do everything that's to underneath that line and you don't worry about anything that's above the line in the short term. Hence why businesses are right now going through this whole process and they're getting engineers involved, they're getting all of these things. But again, these are long-term questions and so there's long-term payback periods involved with investing capital and again, hence where the actuarial thought can come into it. These aren't just short-term questions, these are long-term questions. So the marginal abatement cost curve, very critical. The last one is what they call carbon management across the value chain. So you've got a traditional value chain, upstream, downstream, and then all the way from R&D, right the way through to recycling. So you could apply that to anything that you create. You think about it, so you start off with R&D, you buy your raw materials, you manufacture it, you distribute it, you sort of sell it at the end consumer uses it, and then at the end you've got a recycling one. Carbon management activities really need to occur across the entire value chain for this thing to work. And there are six elements to what a proper carbon management activity would have. It would have, firstly, where do you source your energy from? You know, and this is not in any particular order, but firstly, where do you source your energy from? Do you buy it from renewable sources? Do you buy it from coal-fired sources, et cetera, et cetera? Second one is, how do you use your energy? So you've thought about where you buy it from, then you think about how do you use it? Do you use it in an energy-efficient manner? And again, that goes to the light globe question, that goes to the manufacturing processes, all these sorts of things. You then think about your supply chain, up and down, hence the upstream and downstream. Your upstream suppliers, where are they getting their inputs from? Are they getting their inputs from energy-intensive places or are they getting their inputs from low-intensive places? Product opportunities, downstream, think about where you can sell, what are the new product opportunities that are going to come out of this, things like that. Behavioural change, clearly consumers' behaviours will change, but also businesses' behaviours will change, so that's going to be an interesting one. And then last but not least, offsetting and waste management, that sort of says, okay, well, what can you do on that recycling end, and how might you be able to do things from an offsetting perspective? But there's six very fundamental activities that happen in any carbon management. So when a business prepares its carbon management plan, and a lot of businesses are doing that at the moment, they really look at each of these six dimensions, not just one. A lot of people tend to think that it's really that first one. A lot of people tend to focus on, oh, well, let's just get rid of the coal-fired power stations and, you know, everything will be hunky-dory. And that's just one element of it. There's all of these other elements that you have to think about as well. Okay, so hopefully that's given you a bit of a sense of what I guess, you know, has driven the impacts to businesses, what are the sectors that are impacted, things like that. I want to spend now some time, and hopefully this will stimulate some discussion around opportunities for actuaries. Where does the profession and where can the profession go out of all of this? So I guess I've taken some of these words directly off the website, so apologies, I haven't actually footnoted that that's the source, but the Institute's website says actuarial work involves adding risk assessment to longer-term financial contracts. And there's lots of these lovely words that I'm sure most of you think about on a day-to-day basis. You know, design insurance policies, calculate premiums, advice on reserving and prudent distribution of profits, investment policy, et cetera, et cetera. I then said, okay, well, what about climate change? In reality, climate change just adds risk to long-term, instead of financial contracts, business operations and financial contracts. You know, notice the key words. Risk assessment adds risk, long-term, long-term. Very similar. What is going to be different is that you may not be doing these things, you'll be doing other things. That's the whole essence of it, you know. But it's the same concept, and that's what I want to try and, as I said, stimulate debate, stimulate discussion, because there are opportunities out there. And the last one, this will provide a significant growth opportunity for the profession. I'm a firm believer of that. I think there are going to be huge opportunities for the profession, and now is the time to capitalise on it. I guess moving beyond traditional areas is the next thought that I have. I would say, you know, and maybe I'm being incorrect here, but I would say that, you know, a lot of actuaries at the moment are obviously thinking about the first one. How is climate change going to impact what I'm doing today? So for people in general insurance, they're probably thinking about floods and bushfire increases and exclusions to policies and all of those sort of things. People in life insurance might be thinking about mortality and morbidity changes. That's great, you know, and that should continue going and not a problem there. Where I think the opportunity is the new thinking to say, okay, that's great, but let's now use our traditional actuarial techniques to think about problems from a climate change policy and the rest of industry. And some examples, which I'll go through in the following slides, how maybe to apply the control cycle in assessing caps and gateways, thinking about reserving techniques in calculating forestry permits, or thinking about extreme value theory to forecast maximum electricity demand. You know, just they're different sorts of innovative examples of how you might be able to apply actuarial thinking. So if we start with the first one, permit creation for reforestation. And this is a simple case study. I mean, it's not based on anything factual. It's just sort of, you know, concept. A land developer investigating the potential to generate carbon permits from a project. So they own a block of land, you know, hectares out in the bush or whatever, and they're saying, okay, how can I make some money? The important thing is that the number of permits that the government will issue are going to be based on a lot of things, like what actions they take, but also what natural disturbances there are. In addition, there is a need known as a reversal type buffer that, you know, they'll need to plant additional trees to cater for unforeseen events and provide this buffer. Again, that is a traditional actuarial problem, just under a different guise, where you turn around and saying, okay, well, what might that buffer need to be? What might be the distribution of outcomes? You know, all of those sort of things. That's exactly like a traditional actuarial problem, just in a very different guise. So that's one. Any questions or comments on this one? Has anyone out there actually looked at this, for example, in their day-to-day work at the moment? Hence, it's the long-term view of the world. That's, I guess, the essence of it. It's not a short-term view of the world. It's a long-term view of the world. I'll bypass that one. I'll have a look at this third one, maximum demand on energy networks. First statement, rising temperatures and heat waves are causing increased risks of power shortages. I mean, what happened, you know, in Victoria in January, there was 46-odd degree days a few days in a row. That did cause power shortages through unexpected and unplanned electricity demand. A bit of background, demand forecasting has traditionally been done using trend analysis, economic measures, and regression type analysis. But what it doesn't allow for is these extreme events. Again, classic actuarial thinking, extreme value theory, for example, what's applied in general insurance and then was adopted by the operational risk guys. Same sort of thing. You know, that could be used to think about how to help businesses plan for what is the likely maximum demand over the next 5 or 10 years. Because, again, these infrastructure questions, you can't just build a network overnight. You need to be able to build a network over a number of years, and you're talking billions of dollars of investment. This is something, you know, that, again, is traditional actuarial fodder that could be used and could be, you know, I guess, used to help build the profession's profile and capability out there. And this is, I mean, the New South Wales government has just announced, I think, this weekend that they're going to spend $18 billion on revamping and rebuilding parts of the New South Wales industry in terms of the infrastructure. So you're talking large sums of money over long periods of time. But I would bet, you know, pretty much anything that they would not have a good understanding of what the likely maximum demand and hence what the real requirements are. I would be very surprised if they do. Last slide very quickly, how we can make it happen, I guess, and what are we doing? The Energy Environment Committee, we're recognising this and we're working on this. So the first thing that we're doing is refocusing and refining the committee name, probably to call it the Climate Change Committee. We're looking at the mission, the terms of reference, and then it's these four things in particular that we are working on. We're going to get actively engaged in the policy debate that's happening throughout the balance of this year. We're going to work on some innovative research and thought leadership, and that's where we need you guys to really help us in that area. We'll be developing education in inverted commas materials. I mean, obviously not education in the sense of a formal subject, but at least to raise the awareness and education. And last but by no means least, website and other profile enhancements, so that when people come to the Institute's website and they look at what we do, for example, in the energy space or the climate change space, there'll be more meaningful and up-to-date information than what's there at the moment. And that's it. Any questions? I open it up to the floor.
Sim from Actuarial Society of Hong Kong. I was actually interested in one of your early slides, Peter, and it was really with regards to how much the reduction actually happens when it's just in the Western world, and you actually need the developing world actually to reduce that to a much, I guess, more sustainable sort of level. Has there been any thought of how this, what sort of international structure can be set up to implement this? And I guess my one thought that came to my mind as you showed the downstream effect was actually, would there be some sort of, I guess, import tax or import structure in terms of carbon when things are imported from certain areas of the world, for example, where they haven't actually implemented this yet?
It's an absolutely brilliant question there, Sim. I guess two things. Firstly, you're right. You need the developed world and the developing world to get into this, firstly. Secondly, there has been some work and some debate in that space. I mean, in December this year, there's a massive climate change conference in Copenhagen, at which point they're hoping to reach the sort of Kyoto 2, so where to beyond this Kyoto Protocol. In recognition, however, the Australian government is recognising that international linkages are really critical. We can't do this on our own. We need to make sure that there's international linkages. Whether or not it's a tax or if it's a trading scheme, that's a big question out there. Certainly, most of the developed countries are moving more towards a trading scheme. Europe already has one. America has signalled their intention for one. Australia has, you know, the draft bill is pretty much a trading scheme. But the question is going to come, how do you then protect industries, as you said? What happens if, you know, your neighbouring or competing country doesn't have one? Let's say China, for example, doesn't have a scheme, and Australia does. How do you compete with Chinese imports? And that's the big question. The way the government's thinking about doing at the moment is through the assistance measures and the transitional measures, in the hope that at Copenhagen there'll be some sort of a direction internationally around a truly global agreement rather than just being a developed world agreement. But that's a massive step still to take, massive step.
So, Martin Hitwin, just a question on international linkages. I went to a presentation recently which an analyst suggested that because, as I understand, the plan scheme in Australia doesn't have any limit on using international credits, that up to 70% of the emission reductions may be basically taken by international credits rather than actual reductions in Australia from Australian businesses. And just your view on the appropriateness of that, and how you see that going forward.
Yep. I guess I've seen similar research and similar discussion around that, and that is a hotly debated topic at the moment, that the government is still under consideration. But certainly the way that it's currently drafted, the legislation will allow what they call unlimited imports of permits. So basically you could, in theory, source all of Australia's requirements from overseas. And this puts it in context in terms of the volumes. You know, there's 2,061 million tonnes in Europe. There's about 500-odd million tonnes in Australia. So you could, in theory, source all of it from there and from the CDM and from anywhere else, in theory. I mean, in practice it may not happen, but in theory you can. I guess what the government is looking at doing is, I guess, firstly having a truly global perspective in Copenhagen, number one. Number two, they may well limit the amount of imports, so that's still a possibility that in the underlying regulations they may well say, okay, we'll put a cap until such time as there is a truly global agreement. From my personal perspective, if you roll the clock forward in 10 years' time, and let's just say there is a truly global carbon market, it shouldn't matter where you source your permits from, because it's a global issue, not just a local issue. But I think in the short term, I think you're right, because what it can do is cause distortions and also reduce Australia's competitiveness. Because if we invest in the right technology in Australia now, we could set ourselves up for being much more competitive down the track. So I think in the short term it is a problem, in the long term probably not.
Jeff, Jeff Atkins, Pete, just in terms of your very last slide, who are the professional groups and occupations that currently have got their foot on this space of measuring and validating?
This one here? The measuring and the validating, I guess, there are two parts. The measuring is really the engineers primarily that are out there and the scientists, and there are a number of really large organisations that have built a good name for themselves, and, you know, Energetics, for example, is one that's gone out there. EML, there are a number of engineering slash, you know, sort of science-based firms that do the measurement really, really well. The validation one is really, really, I guess, the accounting-type firms that are getting into that space to an extent, you know, really hinging off the fact that they're going to be, I guess, you know, auditing financial-based information, so auditing this sort of information is probably very similar. And in fact, there are requirements in the draft bill that sort of says it has to be audited by someone of significant reputation and standing and all of those sort of things. So, you know, the accounting firms are moving that way. But I guess where I see the actuarial side is really not in the measurement and the validation, because that's really, I guess, more compliance functions. I see that we're here to help solve the commercial problems and the strategic and the policy problems that sort of say, well, you know, how much money should you invest now to reap the benefits over the next 50 years? You know, where should the government be setting its broader policy direction to be able to maximise the value for Australia? You know, and you liken it to the superannuation type debate, and there are a lot of similarities, as I said, you know, the long-term nature, the uncertain nature of the incomes and the expenditures,